Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The FT.
Where there's a will, there might not always be a way. As the Court of Appeal overturns a parent's decision to cut a child out of her will, we ask what implications the case has for those leaving a legacy behind to their families. Plus, we examine some unusual alternative investments that investors are increasingly turning to in the search for income, and look into the alarming ways that some British holidaymakers who book accommodation online are being swindled out of thousands of pounds. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Claire Barrett, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Judith Evans and James Pickford, plus our special studio guest Andrew Wilkinson, partner at the law firm Shakespeare Martineau. This week, a judgment over a disputed will by the Court of Appeal reminded those of us hoping to leave behind a legacy that our dying wishes may not be the last word. This case concerned a woman in her 50s who'd been estranged from her late mother and subsequently cut out of her will. Although she was her only child, her mother left nearly £500,000 to three large animal charities instead, a decision that the Court of Appeal overturned this week, awarding the daughter around a third of the estate so she could buy the house she lived in. I'm joined in the FT studio by Andrew Wilkinson, partner at the law firm Shakespeare Martineau, who specialises in disputed wills and probate. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today. Now, for those listeners who haven't heard of this case, could you summarise why the Court of Appeal made this unusual judgment?
So this case, I think, confirms the position, as has been the law for a while, which is that essentially it's not as simple as just assuming that if you can make a will leaving your assets to whoever you want. This is essentially prevents you from doing that in certain circumstances. And in certain circumstances, the court will intervene where they consider that reasonable provision has not been made for a certain category of person. Now, that category can be a variety of different people. Obviously, in this case, it was an adult child. Mm-hmm. But similarly, it does apply to cases of cohabitees and other people who might be maintained by someone who's passed away. Historically, these sorts of claims were often brought by minor children and in circumstances which are sort of fairly easy to understand, where they've been left, you know, parents perhaps died prematurely and they haven't, by operation of the law or otherwise, haven't been left anything under their will. This was a different case, obviously. She was an adult beneficiary. She was in her 50s, as Claire has said. The key is that this case isn't going to open the floodgates to lots of claims by adult children. These cases are very limited on their facts. And also, adult children can only bring claims generally where they're in a financial need.
And in this case, the woman had to prove to the court that she had a very low income,
yeah.
She had no pension, she didn't own her own house, and she was reliant on benefits to fund her lifestyle, which is one of the major reasons why she was awarded.
And
the
absolutely,
money.
I think if she'd been in, you know, if she'd been much younger, you know, in her 20s, 30s, and had career prospects ahead of her, I think it would have been a different situation.
Now, nevertheless, you've noticed that the 1975 Inheritance Act, which is what brought about this claim, is increasingly being used by adult children. Now, while it's relatively rare, perhaps, for a child to be cut out of a will, lawyers that I've spoken to this week say that they're finding it's much more common for one child to be favoured over another for various reasons. And this can also lead to a a claim theoretically being brought under the same act. So give me some examples of how those kinds of disputes could happen.
This was obviously a fairly stark example where everything had been left to charity to the exclusion of the daughter. And of course, lots of cases aren't as stark as that. There's lots of competing interests, and you know, some of the estate might be left to someone, and the rest of some of the estate might be left to someone else. You know, in terms of sort of typical cases where these situations arise, common themes that I've spotted: the increasing rise of second families. There's lots of disputes between, for example, children from a first marriage and second or third type spouses. Where there's a sort of discrepancy in earnings, so where certain children have been favoured over others for perhaps perfectly legitimate reasons.
Because one may be a nurse, one may be an investment banker,
yeah.
So you'd want to leave more
money
to
exactly. And I think it's the timing of these is always difficult, and they're often not about what they're about. They become the focus of a lot of family aggravation and dispute that's kind of built up over years. You know, this case, it's very fact-specific, and it does turn on its facts. But that said, I think the ongoing publicity that this case and similar ones will generate, I think, will only mean that these sorts of claims become more common. People know about them. People are getting more litigious. But I also think there's a sort of external factor, which is in terms of people planning for their future or not planning, and the effect that the recession has had on that. I've seen a rise over the last few years of people becoming expectant, relying on inheritances. And it means that when they don't happen, they fight for them.
Well, in fact, you could say that while only a handful of these disputes might end up in court, the rise in people prepared to kick off that you're seeing is showing us that more and more young people are reliant on the fortunes of the baby boomer generation, who, let's not forget, have enjoyed final salary pensions, an unending rise in house prices, it may seem, and all kinds of favourable government policies, which has enhanced their wealth at the same time when the younger generation is seeing their wealth diminished by having to pay for university fees, less generous pensions, etc., etc. So the inheritance is really becoming a battleground of the future. From what,
and of course, it's all sort of it all creates its own expectation, because the sort of reliance on parents and for deposits on houses and all the other support that people get as they're sort of growing through life, I think that's kind of only serves to fuel the expectation and reliance on that inheritance at the end of the day.
Now, in your job, you're advising families, often in difficult circumstances, who are planning on leaving a legacy or who are fighting over one at the end. From the benefit of your professional experience, how can our listeners and readers guard against their families fighting over a legacy in future? What should they be doing?
The obvious one, and I think it's overlooked far too often, is just talking to your family about what you're going to do and having these sorts of open conversations about this is the estate, this is what I want to do about it, and involve them in the process. I see far too many cases where these things come as a huge surprise, and almost it's the surprise that causes as much harm as anything else. Ideally, do it at the time when you're making the will. But if that's not possible, and I appreciate that sometimes that's not possible for various reasons, write a letter explaining what you've done and why you've done it, just so people have a better understanding as to why you've done it and the reasons for it. Of course, these things can be something of a double-edged sword. There's always a risk that, of course, they sort of benchmark an expectation, and that the mere fact that you've mentioned not providing for someone might imply that there's some obligation on you to do so. So they can be a bit of a double-edged sword, but I think most of the time, explaining to people why you've done it and what you've done, I think, is helpful.
And while you're still alive,
absolutely,
would be preferable. Well, thank you very much, Andrew, for joining us and for the benefit of your advice there. Still to come on the FT Money Show, if you're about to jet off on holiday before you set off into the sunset, listen to the scams that some unlucky holiday makers who booked their accommodation online have unfortunately fallen victim to. Before that, this week's FT Money cover feature examines the lure of alternative investments that investors are increasingly turning to in the search for income. I'm joined in the studio by FT Money reporter Judith Evans, who's been investigating the pros and cons of an array of weird and wonderful asset classes. So, Judith, you're telling us in FT Money this week that retail investors now have hurricane insurance and caravan parks in their investment portfolios. How on earth has this happened?
Well, that's right. Within a lot of ready-made portfolios that people buy, whether that's in the form of a multi-manager fund or a wealth manager's portfolio or something similar, there increasingly will be so-called alternatives. That's a bit of a catch-all, but it generally refers to asset classes that are not straight-up equities, bonds or property, and that often offer a higher yield than you can get from equities or bonds at the moment. And that's really the key. Investors are desperate for income. And with interest rates low and bond yields low, fund managers are really looking a bit further afield in the search.
Now, other than hurricane insurance and caravan parks, what other alternatives have you looked into this week?
Well, there are a few of them. A big one recently has been peer-to-peer lending. That's existed for about 10 years, but you've been able to buy it in the form of an investment trust for the past year. And that's really led a lot of multi-asset fund managers and equity fund managers to put money into it.
Right.
Another one is renewable energy. That's another sector which has really ballooned over the past 2 years or so. We're not sure right now where that's going, given that the government seems to have changed its mind a bit about green subsidies, but it's certainly done well for
Indeed.
Investors over those 2 years.
And aircraft leasing, I understand, is another area that fund managers are looking at.
That's another one, yes. There are these funds which buy aircraft and then rent them out to airlines. That obviously generates a steady rental income, but there are risks, including are the planes valued correctly and is the airline creditworthy? Having had the example recently of Malaysian Airlines, that's a bit of a cautionary tale on many levels.
So obviously the risks are higher, but what kind of returns are potentially on offer to investors and funds?
Well, it varies by the asset class, but peer-to-peer global investments, one of the really popular trusts, is targeting a yield of 6 to 8%. Some of these asset classes offer even higher yields.
Wow. So it sounds very tempting, but should self-directed investors be buying into these trends?
No, they should not. These are asset classes which multi-managers and the rest have been investigating closely, but most retail investors don't have the capacity to do that. And in fact, there have been a number of scandals relating to direct sales of asset classes that really aren't suitable for you and me to be buying on our own. For example, student accommodation or life settlements, which are the life insurance policies of US pensioners.
The so-called death bonds.
That's right. So this really is a case of leave it to the experts, I think.
So if investors are looking to gain access to these higher yielding alternatives via a fund, then there's less of a risk.
That's right. If you buy, for example, a multi-asset fund, it depends on the type, but it may well have an alternatives allocation, and that will likely be limited by various regulations, so you can be confident that your fund managers will not go overboard in buying crazy asset classes.
Well, as always, the lesson is look at the small print. But thank you very much. That was Judith Evans, and you can read much more about her assessment of various different alternatives in this week's edition of FT Money. Before our final item, a reminder that you can read this week's FT Money as part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, or read us online at ft.com/money and follow us on Twitter at FT Money. Now for our final item. The rise of online accommodation booking means more and more of us are turning to the internet when we book accommodation to go on holiday abroad. However, there's been a corresponding rise in the number of scams affecting holiday makers who've chosen this way of booking a holiday. I'm joined by James Pickford, the deputy editor of FT Money, who's been looking into the various scams which are going around at the moment. James, welcome to the show. First of all, can you start by telling us, how do these scams work? Are there different types?
There are. I mean, it's really the most horrendous scenario where you let's say you've had a very long journey with your family and the kids are tired and fractious.
Are we there yet?
It's hot. You arrive at your dream villa and only to find that some other family has booked it. They're already there. No one's heard of you. And you've paid for a holiday that essentially doesn't exist. And this comes about because fraudsters are at the point of booking are able somehow to intercept emails that you might be sending to the owner and essentially pose as that owner and redirect these emails to them and then ask for payments which go to their bank accounts and then obviously they vanish. But there are other little variants on it. They
Right.
can construct completely sort of fictitious websites, advertising villas. They can try and list fake villas or homes on some of the big sites, although the big sites are pretty vigilant about this. But you know, they do try and do that and therefore get your money that way. And of course, quite apart from that, if you get into a sort of communication with a villa owner who turns out not to be a villa owner, they can simply try and get your payment details and do just as you would with any other sort of communication. They might try and use those details to get into your bank account. And last year, ABTA and the City of London Police said that there was £2.2 million worth of this kind of fraud in the UK.
And that's presumably just the fraud that's been reported to them. But it's not always the holiday maker who ends up getting scammed. It can actually be the owners of the villa who lose out as well, you found.
You're quite right. It's very unusual, this, but an owner might get into hot water where they're approached by someone who says, yes, a wonderful villa, I'd love to book it for 2 or 3 weeks and sometimes longer. And you think, that's great, I've got 4 weeks booked out. And then the story goes that they did originally have another booking with another owner of a holiday home. There was some sort of catastrophe, a flood or the roof fell in, and therefore that owner, having taken their money, is going to have to refund them. But of course, the other place, they say, was much more expensive, so that cost £5,000 compared to your £3,000 charge. They say, well, very simple. Why don't I get the other owner to send you a check? You receive that, bank the check, and then, you know, by bank transfer, you can give me the difference.
Yeah.
And there we go. All very simple. Of course, that happens. The check arrives from the supposed other owner. You put it in the bank. It appears to go in, as many foreign checks will. They appear to deposit perfectly safely. You then transfer your money, but then a check bounces, which can happen. And suddenly this person has vanished. So that's another variant.
Well, what can you do to stop yourself from being scammed is the obvious question to ask.
Well, there are warning signs. There are precautions you can take. If you're looking at a website and you see, and you're particularly if you're making a payment, but any sort of secure transaction, you should be there should be on the web address HTTPS as
yes,
the beginning of a secure thing.
A crucial
and
S.
Any little variance in the way in the spelling of the website or that sort of thing might suggest, you know, that's a big alarm bell for someone trying to fake a website. You can also take a look when you're looking at holiday homes or villas or whatever. You should have a look for reviews. If there aren't very many of them, if there's only one or two reviews, it suggests there might be something up, particularly if that doesn't correlate with the amount of length of time that the thing has been advertised.
If the reviews are quite scant in what they're saying.
The reviews are very scant, yes. And you can also use payment systems that the companies running these home websites, home rental websites, provide. Or credit cards, you know, with bank transfer or cash, there's absolutely no recourse really, if you make the mistake. And then, of course, if you are booking a six-bedroom villa in Ibiza for 2 weeks and this was being offered to you at £500, then maybe you should think twice because that is just too cheap, you know. The other thing, of course, is to not engage in email communication with people where they're trying to tempt you off-grid, as it were. So if you're going through one of the reputable sites, they will have their own messaging communication system. If someone says, actually, let's do this off the grid, treat that with extreme caution.
That should be a big warning sign. Well, as ever, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. But thank you very much there, James Pickford, FT Money's deputy editor, and hopefully that will avoid you and your family ending up in a nightmare holiday scenario this summer. Now, before you jet off, we'd love to know what you think about alternative investments, the perils of will writing, or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch with us via email. Our address is money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at FTMoney. And you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else is in this weekend's edition. If you work for a blue chip company, we'll be looking into the array of FTSE share save schemes that are maturing this month and whether you should invest as an employee. And as usual, we've shared tips from our sister publication, The Investor's Chronicle, and the latest director's deals. The FT Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Judith James, and our special studio guest, Andrew Wilkinson.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.